I just finished my shiur in last week. Last Wednesday, Thursday, I gave Yibchina. And so, I mean, I'm not sure that I'll be able, I mean, to perform the way I'm used to. What I'm trying to do tonight is simply to analyze a few rashis in the parashas Aseret Divrei. As a matter of fact, I have worked out all the rashis in parashas Aseret Divrei, but I believe it will spend evening on three or four short sentences of rashis. It's very important for us now, I mean for us, I mean Rabbonim as well as people in the educational field, and even Talmid Chachamim who are in the profession, to delve in Divrei Chazal, the sayings of our sages and rabbis, to understand them well. I mean, we are very careful with Aloche, we've been very negligent as far as our God is concerned. Now in Iraq, which tremendous problems arise, society is in a state of flux, many verities are being questioned, many foundations are undermined, there is exploration, questing, our objectives are known to the people who do the questing, and the rabbi's task today is compounded, very complex. And it's important that he should be able to, not phonologically, but logically, philosophically, to take modern events and place them in our old biblical Talmudic Agadic frame of reference. I'm trying to do it tonight. And the ideas that I'll express are well known to all of us. But however, the frame of reference is new. The first pasuk of the Aseret Divrei begins by Dabar Elikim Es Advorim Moil Eleimo. If you have the Rashi, Rashi says Ein Elikim Elodayon. As a matter of fact, the four words plus the fifth word Ein Elikim Elodayon Liporea are quoted from the Mechilta. The rest is consists of Rashi's comment to the Mechilta. Ein Elikim Elodayon Liporea, unquote Mechilta. Now Rashi has his own. Lepishiyesh parshiyesh shebateiro. Shimosam odom mekabel schar. Vim lav eine mekabel aleyen puroniyes. Yochel, some echo, I mean, couldn't be in this. There's a sound, there is a... Yochel at Aseret Divrei kach Talmud Lema.
Put up the mic.
Talmud Lema Vaidaber Elikim Dayon Liporea. Very hard to guess. In my opinion, Rashi's text was identical with our text. Rashi added simply commentary. Perhaps Rashi had a different text of the Sifri. And it's a straight quote from the Sifri. Let me just, for the sake of those who don't belong to the Rabbinical Council of America, I'll translate us. The word Elikim is the term for a judge. Since there are chapters in the Torah of such a character, that if a person observes the commands contained therein, you will receive a reward. And if you never observe them at all, you will not receive punishment on their account. One might think that the Ten Commandments are also of such a character, that no punishment will follow upon the infringement of them. Therefore, the scripture expressly states, God spoke, God who is judge exacting punishment spoke. Do you understand the meaning? I don't. As a matter of fact, I'm not going to explain the Rashi. I want to just explain the Mechilta, Ein Elokim Dayan Liparea. But since we read the Rashi, Rashi most probably, as all the portion of Rashi assume, refers to, Rashi speaks about chapters, which, if one does not observe them, he's not punished. However, if he does comply with them, he receives the reward. And I could be misled into thinking that brother said that Aseret HaDibrei, this chapter belongs to that class, that the non-observance, one does not incur punishment by non-observance, but receives reward by observance. Therefore, that's why by Zabir Rekim, the king spoke, and the king means the judge exacting punishment. What chapter is Rashi speaking about? It's a mystery, it's an enigma. What chapter? Most probably, the commandments and the chapters referred by Rashi to are those which are to be observed only when the conditions specified are present. For instance, if one wears a garment four corners, he must provide the latter, the garment with stitches. However, if he doesn't wear the garment at four corners, he is not supposed, he's not commanded to provide the garment with stitches. Yes, however, if he does put on a garment at four corners and provide them with stitches, he receives reward. For the absence of the garment, by not wearing the garment, he does not incur punishment. Or, for instance, the Makir, the Sidney Bayes Chodosh Vasisa Makir again. If I build a house, and the house is a flat roof on which people walk or people take. And times I have to build a railing around in order to prevent people from falling. However, if the roof, if I have no house or the roof is planted, not flat, no people, walk on the roof, so there is no mitzvah mark. If I build a house, that roof, and I make a market, I'm rewarded. But non-building, abstaining from building a house with a flat roof, does not incur any punishment. Also, a mezuzah. If I live in a house and there is a door frame, I have to attach a mezuzah, to nail down a mezuzah to the door frame. If there is no door frame, there's no mitzvah mezuzah. However, if I make a door frame, I fulfill a mitzvah, and of course, then I receive a reward. So what does Rashi say? I might assume that Aseret HaDibrei belongs to that class of chapter. Rashi is speaking most probably, as all the forces say, of the so-called mitzvah of shoot. To use the term by the Rambam, the Maimonides term, mitzvah of shoot. It means the mitzvah is binding only in a certain situation, under certain definitive circumstances. There is no duty upon me to involve myself in those circumstances in order to incur the imperative or the duty. However, if I do place myself in such a situation and I comply with the mitzvah, so the reward is assured. Where does Rashi and the Torah mean? First of all, most commandments in that category are negative. Later, you cannot apply the whole idea to a later. The Sirtsa, Signet, Signet, the Sanebracha, the Chokel, the Sachnik, what do I expect to say? What? Not what? I'm not punished what? If I don't kill, I'm certainly not punished. But I don't receive a reward either for not killing. We have only three Mr. Fassay, three positive precepts in the Aseret Adirah. Olechi, Shabbos, and Kabbos. Now what does Rashi say? Shabbos what? I'm not punished what? If I infringe upon the Mr. Shabbos? Or Kabbos Aveim, if I don't observe Kibbos Aveim? But if I don't have a father and a mother on me, you can't do it. If one is an orphan, you cannot fulfill the mitzvah. We don't understand what Rashi means. First of all, 7 out of 10 are lavi. What? The whole problem of mitzvah business is not the table to lavi. 3 are absolute mitzvahs. They bind the person. So without having him getting involved, become involved in a certain situation. We don't understand. As a matter of fact, I was not going to explain the Rashi to you. I suspect that Rashi is talking about something else. As a matter of fact, I haven't written it out. Rashi apparently thinks, since the Aseret Adibrei, or according to Rav Sadia Goyen, to Rashi, Rabbi Nachman ben Rambam, and most Rishonim concur with him, so to say, the principle or the root of the system of Tayag mitzvah. So each lav in the Aseret Adibrei somehow has a corresponding assay which requires of a person just opposite action. From action which is the reverse, from that which has been prohibited by the law. For instance, the law of the filter. I mean, corresponds to certain assays, or rather has certain assays, corresponds, which require us men to support and to help and to promote and to save and to protect life. And this is the class image. The same is true of resignation. And the same is true of the Sanhedrin Achrei Choker. On the contrary, you should tell the truth. Tzedek, tzedek, tzedek. As far as the truth is concerned, the Sanhedrin Aldam Reacho, and so forth. Kiyipel Anefo, the Sisu Makele Gagyacho, and so forth. And each Lisa saying that Aseret Adibrei is linked up with an essay in other chapters, which requires that man he should engage in action which is the reverse. Positive action, which is the reverse of the sinful action, action which has been prohibited by the Aseret Adibrei. And all those essays are binding. And if I don't fulfill the mitzvah essay, I'll be punished. This is the only way in which I can interpret Hashem. Alright, but this is not my job today, tonight. What I want to interpret is the 5 words of the Meshulteh. But the other Meshulteh you can see, that the Meshulteh does not have the rest. The Meshulteh has Ein, Elokim, Elodai, Liporeya, correct? The Nemar Kavutah. The name Elokim is indicative, according to the Meshulteh, of judgment and a judge exacting punishment. In other words, so what does the Meshulteh mean? Meshulteh Rashi. What does the Meshulteh mean? Exacting punishment. Of course, there is punishment for every violation, for every transgression, and for every fulfillment and implementation of a mitzvah, there is reward. In other words, the sinner is punished wherever the king appears in a parasha, or whenever the king decrees a law, prohibits certain actions, recommends some action, is the violation of any mitzvah decreed by the king is punished during the lifetime of the sinner. Boilam Azeh, this one. Retribution is not delayed until man faces his nature and the world like the case is with other mitzvahs, with regard to other mitzvahs. I am one face on today to practice, tomorrow, left the world and come for to receive them all. Those mitzvahs which are associated with Nei Melekim, any violation of them incurs punishment immediately. Right here and now. That's all that the Nechilta has said. Because the rest consists of Rashi's additional comments. Let us analyze this now. Elikim is characteristic of the idea of retribution and reward, which comes physically during our lifetime. Why? What? How did you feel about it? Chazal has dwelt many times upon the distinction between the Shem Abaye, the Shem Ben Abaye, that's the Ramadan, and the Likim. The Ramban quotes the Midrash in Breishis that with the arrival of man upon earth, the name of God, which appears in the first chapter of Genesis as Elohim, was expanded into Hashem Elohim. The creation of man warranted the addition of Havaye to Elohim. The Ramban expresses himself succinctly by saying, Shem Mole al Elam Mole. The complete name began to prevail in a world which had been completed. Of course, completed with the creation of man. In other words, as long as man was absent from the world, God acted through the Midas Elohim, as Elohim. Very instant, creation was completed by the emergence of man. God has begun to reveal himself not only as Elohim, but as Havaye Elohim. Creation became complete, so has the divine name. In other words, God's relationship to creation is a dual one. As Elohim and as Havaye. Apparently, Midut, nature, both inorganic and organic, is ruled by the Shem Elohim. While nature plus man who is endowed with logos and speech is confronted not only by Elohim but by Havaye as well. What is the distinction between the encounter with Elohim and the encounter of man or confrontation of man with Havaye? Elohim denotes a relationship of might and power. For our planet, Kael, or even Elohim in Hebrew, we come across the term quite often in Tanakh, there's the connotation either of might, stupendous might, or have socio-political power, like being a judge or a ruler. Rashi himself says, Hashem Elohim Eretz B'Shomayim, Hashem Elohim, Hashem Hushmei, Havaye is the genuine name. Elohim, what does Elohim denote? Shalit. The Shefei Al-Kehu. So Rashi expressed himself Palakim has the connotation of Shalit Beishefet, ruler and judge. Abaye is his name, whereas Elohim signifies that he is a ruler and a judge overall. In other words, the name of Elohim symbolizes two orders. First, the cosmic order. Second, the socio-political order. Let us see. First, Elohim stands for causality. It is the general principle governing the cosmic drama. This general principle is to be found in Elohim. For cosmic, it stands for cosmic dynamics, for the boundless reservoir of physical energy, for the natural drama, for the might and grandeur of the universe. In every aspect of those of the universe, you discover the fingerprint of Elohim. Elohim, in this context, is the legislator of the natural law, or of the mathematical equation which rules all cosmic phenomena, all cosmic events. Elohim determines physical events. Elohim reveals himself through the totality of the causal nexus and through the individual event surface. And what is, and it's very strange, people don't understand. Then what is the natural law about which physics speaks, about which chemistry or biology, if not the expression of God's primordial will, which has been embedded in organic and inorganic matter? What is the fall of the stone or the roar of the sea? The flight of the bird, the circular motion of the insect around an electric bulb, the quiet, still summer night, the movement of my finger, my urge for food, is not the manifestation of God's penetration into the depths of nature. Now, let us just speak about certain phenomena in which, I'm about to appear to you very humorous or perhaps funny, but within the context of modern society, it's not funny at all. On the contrary, it's tragic. Violation of the natural law. One can violate not only the moral law, or the religious law. One, human beings are capable of violating the natural law. Violation of the natural law results always in catastrophe. Rebellion against the rule of Elohim, expressing itself through the causal link to the dynamics of organic and inorganic matter, ends necessarily, inevitably, in disaster. The science, for instance, of the law of, and please don't laugh at me, the science of the law of gravitation by leaping from the 10th floor to the sidewalk will destroy, inevitably, a human life, instantly. It didn't take long. And a diabetic neglecting to observe a sugar-free diet will shorten his life and bring about death, if not instantaneously, at least gradually. Peace. An alcoholic will finally develop some disease, like cirrhosis of the liver, and end his life tragically. And so God does not tolerate violators and transgressors of the natural law which he has established for the cosmos and man alike. And when I'm speaking about violators of the natural law, I want you to understand, don't look at me in amazement and good humor. I am not discussing now maniacs or psychopaths with suicidal tendencies who defy the natural law. The Vayemer Elokim Yehi. In our biblical lingo, the natural law means Vayemer Elokim Yehi. I am referring to historical eras, to cultural climate, to hedonic-minded societies, which are driven almost compulsively to rebel against the Elohim, as expressed through the natural law. What is cultural decadence? People speak many times about cultural decadence. They speak about the cultural decadence of late Rome in antiquity. Now people begin to speak about cultural decadence of the Western world, and about the United States. What is cultural decadence? What is it characteristic of? It is, of course, characteristic of a tired, frustrated society who was overambitious, overzealous, and tried to reach the impossible, standing on the brink of disaster, and trying very hard to violate the natural law. Decadence expressed itself in a tendency, in a quest, I would say in a compulsive drive, to defy the natural order, or rather to defy the authority of the one who has decreed that natural order. People try to defy not only the moral law, but the cosmic law as well. What is the curse, for instance? If you read so much about it, and it is true, I don't know what men can do, I'm afraid it's too late. What is the curse of pollution? Who polluted the air? Who polluted the water? Or as you'll tell me, industry. But what happened? Not industry. It's mother man. It's technologically minded man. Men striving for power, for control, for absolute, complete control over the environment. Men who simply defy the natural law. What is the evil contained in synthetic additives to food, which in many cases are detrimental to human health? What is wrong with them? I mean from a theological, metaphysical standpoint. I'm not speaking about what chemistry of food. What is wrong with the drive or with the urge to take toxic or intoxicating drugs? What is psychologically, what is metaphysically, what does lie at the root of such mad urges, such anomalous drives in man? And it's not limited now to a group of some psychopaths. It's not a universal phenomenon, a universal experience. I mean, it has penetrated not only the schools of America, but unfortunately the yeshivas of America as well. No one can protect, no yeshiva, no left or right, a little bit of precursors, is protected or shielded from that curse. As a rabbi, people of God, that understanding not only in psychological terms, usual psychological terms, can only explore the surface, not the depth, but from a theological viewpoint. This is the defiance of man, the defiance of the authority of God. It's funny. The defiance expressed itself not only in the downbringing of the moral law, but in transgressing and violating the cosmic law, the natural law. It is a rebellion against the rebellious level. Such a rebellion which tries to change the natural law, the natural cause of events and things, must end in disaster. Ein Elohim, if you try to interfere with the authority of Elohim, as expressed throughout the cosmic fabric of events and phenomena, I will die only for you. A very strict severe judge who accepts punishment. In a word, the natural law is basically an existential law. Men cannot reject it without destroying himself. He either accepts the natural law, or he should be ready to terminate his own existence. Now, this is Elohim Shalit. But Rashi has said that Elohim is not only Shalit, Elohim also is Shalit. The judge. However, as we've remarked before, we find the name Elohim related to God's activity not only as a creator, architect, and master of the universe, but also as legislator, king and ruler of human society, of mankind as such. Elohim denotes both Shalit, unrestricted, cosmic, energistic might, he created to sustain and support the universe. Without him, creation would be dominated momentarily, and the world would be in shambles. As well, it denotes also social sovereignty and unlimited power at the socio-political level, as king, as almighty ruler and judge. You know very well that Elohim is an art of Chumash, as many times as you will meet. Elohim is the Kalil. Very interesting that Allah has the right to accumulate the following two prohibitions, two injunctions. One injunction against blasphemy, Elohim is man. In this sense, Elohim is man, is to be interpreted, referring to Kodesh Baruch Hu, and Elohim is the Kalil and Kalil Dayan. The judge is man. The Nigash Balabai tell the king. Balabai should bring it before the court, before judges. As Elohim judge, God is also a lawmaker, and rather say, the legislator. What law does he legislate? And shall it be legislate or the natural law, the mathematical equation, the link between phenomena and the past. As Elohim judge Shevet, he legislates the moral law. His law is not about matter, is not related to matter, to the behavior of matter, but to the behavior of man. As a matter of fact, matter, inorganic, organic, is by far more obedient than man. We read in Parshas Noach about the seven universal principles, or laws, principles of morality, which were addressed to Noach and his children. It's quite characteristic that suddenly the Torah changes the Shem Havayah into Elohim. By Vayivarech Elohim, as Noach has done before the Torah, employs the Shem Havayah. But if they begin to speak about the Sheva Mitzvahs and Stavut Melech, there is a sudden change, a sudden transformation. The Shem Havaya turns into the King. By Vorech Elikim es Neach Lesbanas, by Yim Alehem, Hu Hu, Mille Zoharet, Meachem Vechitchen Yiyakob Chayes Zoharet, Vaporit HaShomayim. Rak, Hak, Bosa Benafshid Dome Lesechevu, Rak, Es Dimchel Benafshid Sechem Erich, Yad Kolchal Yad Rishana, Yad Odom, Yad Yishochi Yad Rishas Nefesh Odom, Shif Adam Odom, Bodom Dome Yishochi, Kedet Zolem Elikim Asa Chalam. Havaya Yad Rishas. The moral social laws, which is the foundation, which are the foundation of any civilized society, were placed at the same level as the physical cosmic law. And the king is the legislator of both, the law governing the gravitational pull, the electromagnetic field, which make the custom world function, and the law prohibiting, as well as the law prohibiting murder, which protects the viability of society. And here again, rebellion against the king as legislator of the social moral law ends in the same manner as disobedience concerning the natural law does, in catastrophe. Retribution, even for the transgression of the moral law, and I wish to warn, some people in the audience who are philosophers, that I'm not speaking about the natural law in the sense of Grotius or Cicero or the medieval scholars. I cannot explain to you the difference because it takes up too much time. But what I'm speaking about is a different concept. Retribution is swift and severe. A society which rejects arrogantly the law, for instance, thou shalt not steal or murder, falls apart as it seems. The Hitler Reich is the most characteristic case in point. Best example. An individual who is over-ambitious, over-zealous, opportunistic, unconscientious as to the means he employs to promote and further his career will be finally cut in web of difficulties and contradictions. As a matter of fact, I believe that America's self-hatred, anomalous self-hatred of today, which is so evident on the campuses and in literature and the press, and her defeatist mood is a consequence of her arrogant and conceit. Her arrogant, conceited, and inflated self-evaluation or self-assessment of yesteryear. Matter of fact, I don't recognize America anymore. When I came to America, America was very self-assured, certain of himself. He thought that America has accomplished everything that is good in civilization and culture. But the rest of the world is just a bunch of illiterates. You can hardly sign their names on a check. If they have checks, if they have money in the bank, on there. And the American, there is American way of life, which is sacred, and it's got to be imitated by everybody, by East and West, by North and South. The educational system is the finest. Man enjoys unlimited liberty and freedom, and so forth and so on. Finally, America was identified and equated with the Golden Age, with the old paradise, which was worth to man, but of man's negligence and rebellion, this lost paradise was found in the United States. A lot of it was true, a lot was childish, infantile, naive. And a lot was due to arrogance. The arrogance in illiterate. The illiterate self-conceived. Now the American just done it. He became meditative, introspective, suffered from self-hatred, whatever is American is bad, whatever is foreign is good. He's exploring the world, for new deities, for new idols, and he's simply not sure of himself. In my opinion, if we believe in Ashgoche, in God's intervention in history, his penetration of human affairs, the mood of today is a result of the mood of yesteryear. One who rejects parental authority will meet the similar treatment on the part of his children. I have experienced it. I don't mean my personal life, but I suffer. Promiscuity leads to complete disintegration of the family fabric, and so forth. Elikim addresses himself to both, to nature and to man, and establishes laws for nature and man. He legislates both concerning the behavior of matter as well as the conduct of man. And violation of those laws precipitate catastrophe and swift retribution. That's exactly what the Nechute meant by a Nechia, the Shem Malachem, the Dabber, the Tim, the Tachlor, the Maile, the Ayon, the Torah. The Aseret HaDibreis means before, why the Nechute says, before in Israel, the Shem Abai, the Torah, not the Shem Abai. Suddenly, they read about, to tell us the story of the Ten Commandments, of the revelation of Sinai, of the Decalogue, which was bestowed upon the people, first on the people, the name is changing to the king. Apparently, those laws, those affairs that you can do, then constitute the foundation of any civilized existence. As we say, are placed at the same level as the Lord's governing nature. So the king established the EA, the velocity of light, the left from magnetic energy, and the king established the law. Thou shalt not murder. Retribution is swift and constant for the violation of all. In short, the penalty is a natural one. The seed of destruction is inherent in the act of violation. It's not an extraneous penalty, but actually catastrophe is a part. Is precipitated by violation, by violating the natural law. In short, the penalty is a natural one. However, when the legislator is Abaye addresses himself to the people, Vayidaber, Vayikro, Abaye, Omeshe, Odom Kiyaches, Mechem Korm, then the commandment is addressed not to natural man, but to metaphysical man. To man who was chosen by God. Such mitzvahs, as Phil, Sukkot, Schaefer, such negative principles, prefects, Rele, Stam, Chelev, Shadness, and so forth, who were destined not to save a natural society from disintegration, but to raise the latter, the natural society, to a committed covenantal community. Those mitzvahs hallow and redeem the human spiritual personality. No compliance affects not natural man, but metaphysical man. It prevents man from achieving spiritual transcendental worth. and distinction. It does not, the natural law, the moral law, the natural moral law, the moral law, the natural moral law, is violated, destroys human dignity. The metaphysical law, which is legislated by a violence, destroys human sanctity all in it. Hence, punishment is not immediate, not risk in coming. Punishment is delayed until that day on which human beings will be confronted by this nature and will have to account for it. Damage is metaphysical, punishment is in the world to come. Well, that's the second rush. I'm through with the mission term. Open the commission. That's the second rush. No. By Daber and Akin, it's called Advori Moel and Lemo. Melamed Shomar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Aseret HaDibreis B'Dibrechot Mashiach Shal Rodom Leimakei. The statement tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu said all these words in one utterance, something that's impossible for the human being to do or to speak in this manner. Right? I would advise you to stop here. Begin a mechuzah. First of all always when I see a drosh bechazal interpretation coming, I always ask. What actually prompted Rashi, motivated Rashi, or the Mechuzah, to say that from the process by Daber and Akin, it's called Advori Moel and Lemeir, you derive that all Ten Commandments were formulated and defined in one utterance simultaneously within the infinitesimal period of time. Because by Daber and Akin, it's Advori Moel and Lemeir, the whole is completely superfluous. And God is spoken, the following word, or the word that follows. Now, the Chazal interpret the process. I mean, we have no sense for Hebrew semantics now. But Chazal knew very well Hebrew semantics. But apparently, and always then they interpret the process. And prima facie, it appears to us as if they made a twist. We should always look into the semantics of the word. And in all cases, we finally realize that it was not twist, but about simply the power of the semantics. The term called has a double meaning, has a twofold meaning, a twofold semantics in the book. So, who could help me out? Just a first. But for instance, let's take a first. Kodesh v'eret v'sheif negeder. In Spain, it's so in Piru v'sheif sheif of Ishmo. What it means? All, in sense, all dwellers of the earth and the residents of the world. In this context, all denotes what? Sum, total, as people, objects, etc. This is simply plain arithmetic. If you have a sum total, you'll say call. Second, call is used quite often as one. Each one means, each one means all. Each one is one. It's sum total. The call is integrated. It's integrated. Piecemeal integrated simply by applying the method of addition, of adding up. If I should add object to object, phenomenon to phenomenon, man to man, I'll finally arrive at the sum. The sum consists of an additive process of integration. And actually, it has been integrated at many parts. Now, it's a Malay Chalkola Ilom, when we emphasize cool lady. What does it mean? Entire in the sense of wholeness. Intrinsic unity and oneness in totality. Proclaim thy kingdom over the whole world. And there is the Hebrew idiom, Alkol Elom Kulei, whole world, nothing should be left out. We have this expression of Kulei as well. I mean, it's not only the one who edited the Mauna. We are limited to the Kulei because it doesn't know Hebrew. Proclaim thy kingdom over the whole world. It's as a whole, as entirety, totality, but intrinsic totality, not integrated. It's not the sum. Not the sum follows the part, but on the contrary, the whole precedes the part. It's not the sum total, but it is total in itself. And I'll give you an halachic example. It's not only a question of semantics. We have a rule, Rube Kipule. You read the rule. This rule of Rube Kipule is not applicable to any pure mathematical quantity. We employ this rule of Rubikikuli only in cases where in our halachic lingo jargon we say a chetze is involved. A chetze is required. I mean, but I know very well, I think that if we can say it only in our jargon, we cannot translate the term into another language, it means a term stands for nothing. If a term stands for an idea, I mean, it must be translatable into any language. What does that mean? A configurative whole. An entity which is intrinsically one. I'll give you an example. You can under no circumstances avail yourself of the principle of Rubik's Cube in a situation when a pure mathematical magnitude is to be dealt with. It would be absurd, completely absurd, to say that Rav Kazai's matzah suffices. You have to eat a Kazai's matzah. Why shouldn't a Rav suffice? Rubik's Cube? You have to, what shall I say, you have to, a mikveh required a boy himself, you know, why shouldn't 21 souls be sufficient in order to declare the mikveh kosher? It's perfect. What's the answer? It's ridiculous to speak about Rubik Kikulei, his references to a sum, to a mathematical quantity, to mathematical measurement. If the Hodesh should be 3 fucking long, you cannot say the two is Rubik's. Because two mathematically is not three. There's no equation of two equals three. It's nonsensical. When we apply the principle of Rubik's equation, for instance, is it correct? Question whether it is the principle, but all right, let's say I'll go along. It's Rubik's equation. Rubik's equation, there's no mathematical quantity involved. It's money. Money is a fact, it's an entity. The ratio can be come as an entity. In a holistic sense, as a configuration, as a whole, must be cut through. So the incision of cross, it suffices. I say, Rube shall double, shall have the tekulet. But you never say, now, linger that Rube shall shiro tekulet. The money may not shiro, but two entities have to be cut full of it. So you say, Rube tekulet. Cut. Yeah, it is the hefte, the entity, has been subjected to shrike. But whenever there is shiur is a mathematical quantity, mathematical number. You cannot say 9 is like 10. It could be a lot. First of all, Mikhail Kule has nothing to do with Rubik Kule. Because for Rubik Kule, you would need rough. You would need at least six and a half hours here. But even mixes again, you have in certain cases the thought, even Shoba, Rob again, Big Dusha. Because Yen is also an entity. Yen is completely not some total, because you have short and you have long. Yen is not measured and determined by the number of hours, but it's a separate entity. It's a unity, I mean. It's a whole. In a holistic sense, I mean, in the sense of Gestalt, there is another problem. For instance, where do you apply Mixta Yim Kikul, excuse me, Rubik Kikul, where else? Shrike, where else? Of course, let me say. Of course, I don't have a different word, Rafhaim. I'm not responsible now, Rafhaim. But I have to defend it, I can defend it, but not tonight. Not tonight. For instance, cost. Arba Keshe Kavayit Matri, you don't apply Rube Kikulei. But as far as Arba Keshe is concerned, is the Sheis Rube Kikulei for cost. That's the problem. Budi Shosre Rube the Kaste is the problem. Why do we apply the principle of Rube Kikulei to cost? We don't apply it to Kavayit Matri. Huh? Because, you see, the mitzvah, the Rambam has never said, and the Mishnah has never said, Val Yitzchus to lay arba ribi shal yayin. The Mishnah and the Rambam always said, Val Yitzchus to lay arba kese shal yayin. And the Rambam, in defining the beauty of drinking 4 cups of wine, says, V'chol echod v'echod bin Yisroel, bin Anoshim, bin Noshim, chayobim lishtei balaylo hazeh, arba kese shal yayin. Of course, there is a minimum prescribed for the cost. The cost must contain not less than Revi. The contents of the cost must not be less than Revi. But this is an element, an attribute, as you say, qualification as far as the cost is concerned. But if it's less than Revi, it's not cost. It's not cost. It's not cost. It's nothing. It's nothing. I mean, you reduce it to ad absurdum, you are living. But once there is release, you know, once the first, the volume of the first equals release, then the mitzvah expresses itself not in drinking a release, but in drinking a cup of wine. And the first becomes, in a holistic sense, a configurative whole, a chesed, a unity, an entity. To which we apply the principle of Rubik Kikulei. And I'll give you an example. What, for instance, if the pot contains not one Rebbe, but 5 Rebbe, or 4 Rebbe? So most Rishonim, there are some who disagree, but most Rishonim say He has got the ring. Brought up the force to fight for you. So what do you see from here? The inference is clear, I mean, and unequivocal. The mitzvah is not to drink revish. Revish is a qualification, is the minimum required for course. Otherwise, it's not worthy, I mean, of the term course. However, the mitzvah refers to course as a whole. That's why you individual. Like in the sense of theory of the soul. And so you apply the principle of approbation. Now, well, the approbation. For what million we don't know. Basically, in what the Rock Sahara you mean? You mean Rock Sahara? It's basically without a time, it is Aloha Aglina, but probably not Aloha Aglina. In order to ask a question and to object to me, you have to introduce a time to her. Tonight I'm not ready to listen. The Mechilte and Rashi have interpreted, apparently by Dabir Elekim as Koladvori Moele, not in the sense of God, all those commandments, because it's completely unnecessary to say all those commandments. It would have sufficed if they had said, like Daber Elohim, that's Advarim, or Eile, not calling the sense of some total, of an integrated sum, of a sum which was added up, a sum which is preceded by component parts, where the individual object has supremacy over the sum, or rather priority, I would say. Apparently, the Jews and Russia have interpreted the Dabar Elohim as Koladvorim or Eile in a holistic sense. And God, no, would you help me out? How I may move with the translation of this process. And God has proclaimed the whole or the entirety or the totality of those commandments. Not each or every of those commandments. If call is not interpreted in terms of every of all of them, ALL, but the totality, the organic unity, or the wholeness of the commandments, of all ten commandments, then call is not interpreted at all. Call injects a new idea of the substance, of the new world. In the world, the Ten Commandments has not been added up ex post facto. They are not an incidental sum of mutually unrelated precepts. The Decalogue constitutes rather a primordial entity whose unity and integrity are inherent in its very essence, or in the very essence of the system. In other words, there are not ten commandments, basically. There is one commandment which branches out into ten essences. Of course, the consequence, the practical consequence, not a question of semantics anymore, the practical consequence is clear and obvious. I don't have to tell it to you, but I would like to learn it, because modern society is not a wrong. The Decalogue is indivisible. You either accept all of the commandments or none at all. To choose between the commandments, and to say Dein Hanyali, Dein Le Hanyali, certain commandments are alike, and I shall accept them. Other commandments I dislike, I shall reject them. To assent to some, and to ignore the other commandments is at best absurd. All of the precepts were pronounced and promulgated in one utterance or within an indivisible, infinitesimal period of time. Of course, you know very well, throughout Jewish history, attempts have been made, and attempts are being made, to split ourselves anyway, you know that very well. To pick out those norms which have, in the opinion of dissidents, nonconformists of all epochs and generations, social moral relevance, and abandon the theological premise expressed in Anechi Elohi Elohim Achayim Alpanai. And that's exactly what the Mechuta thought. You take it literally, it was pronounced in one utterance, but for what for? HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't have to display his omnipotence that he can do it. What did this simultaneous proclamation of all utterance of Dibreis accomplish? What did it convey to us? The organic unity and the indivisibility. That is exactly what the Mechilta meant to say. That the Aseret HaDvarim was formulated simultaneously in one utterance. In other words, the Mechilta denies the bias of what is actually in our daily language. What does the Mechilta reject? What does the Mechilta deny? What does the Mechilta abandon? The Mechilta denies the viability of a secular social morality. Once you divide ourselves into parts, and you separate the social norms from the so-called theological norms, or ritual norms, or from the premise, mainly from the premise on Ether, the Shem HaShemot, on the Yilu, on Zohar, the Meshabot, on Tati, on Sitzer, Shem HaShemot, on Shot, the four cornerstones of our faith, of faith, God, either men accept the authority of God as the legislator of the moral norm, be it individual or social, or gives up his attempt to mold the moral conscience and to organize a society upon the foundation of a man-made relativistic morality. Now, this motif, which I somehow isolated from the mind of Shekulam Nemru, the Gibor Echot, in one atwell, is quite popular in Rashi, in Talmudic literature. Did you quote me in other Maimorim which convey the same message, the inseparability of the moral norm from indomitable faith in God, or the indivisibility of the Aseret HaDvarim? No. The question is whether how they are. Instead of trying to develop homiletical themes, I would suggest that we take it a step further. Well, it's a step further, just a moment. The sector shuas perigimu alochahim. Perigimu alochahim. Very strange kisak. Hanandi ben Chachinoi. Emer. נפש כסימי אומה על ברישם, ותיחש בהמיסה, כפיקודן ובתשומת יועד. They apparently didn't understand why the moral or moral badishes. Nefesh is the hachesh ba'anise, make it cotton as it's the measure, to embezzle funds, embezzle objects, and deny, I mean, theft. Ein adam kefer ba'anise, ad she kefer b'anise. Nonetheless, wherever there is real faith in God, there is no social immorality, there is no embezzlement, there is no denial of theft, there is no perjury. One doesn't take a false oath in order to suppress some information. Stealing, embezzling, perjury are the result of a secular ethic, of a man who wants to build his own moral world, and wants to be the legislator of the moral law which he has prepared. And it is just to tell us another strange story. Pamacha Shabbat the Gubin. I believe it's the only time it's called the Gubin's name. It's very, stops in very for Shabbat. What if you were suffer Shabbat? Come on. That's the philosopher. Probably the Gurea philosopher. Yeah. Omalei, so the philosopher asking that a strange question. Is it sonu? Who is to be held in contempt and hate? Whom should society hate? Whom should society consider as a contemptible creature? Normally, there are cases of Nishibai who have denied the existence of the nature of this nature. The atheist, normally, is the philosopher who has a Romalei, Kabe Gisavichon, Lysirtsov, Lysinov, Ein Adam Kefer Bohem, Ashitesha Bisa. He was asked, most probably by an Epicurean philosopher, who is to be held in contempt? Who is deserving the hate of society and deserves to be excluded from society? Rabbi Ruben answered him immediately, the atheist, the agnostic, the skeptic, who denies the existence of his nature. The philosopher did not understand. The answer, why should a non-believer be held in contempt? And he, since faith is a private affair of the individual, his skepticism is not harmful to society. He expected that Ruben to answer only a fiend of society, an arch criminal who inflicts harm upon others, deserves to be hated. But not an innocent agnostic or atheist. The answer to this question brings swiftly and unequivocally, and was stated in unequivocal terms. The absence of faith in God will lead finally to the downgrade of social morality. Corruption of man is ushered in by the loss of faith. All right, it is plain, no? Okay, we have another minor like that.
I want to show you this word is not just expressed by one.
is the one that's opinion all Kapla Chazal shared. The secular habit is the hope. My function for some time was to file a breakdown, and with this breakdown society will simply go into the bottomless, will plunge into the bottomless abyss. Modern society agrees with this. Dorash ue rabu apis chedrinitis. Yiduchu adishem ko malke oret, tishomu imre picho, mama picho leine emar al imre picho. Bishosh omar akadish boruch honechi vili yolov. Omu hum israelom, לכבידת פני יהודי ראש. He's out for self-glorification. כיוון שאומר כבד את שזיכו ואת נכו, חוזרו לדברי שר השני. רוב אומר מיוחד, ראש דבורכו אמס, ראש דבורכו ולסייב דבורכו, אלא מסייב דבורכו ניכר שראש דבורכו אמס. Is it expressed succinctly and unequivocally? Because if you want to know how indispensable faith is, you just pay attention to the last few divrei, whether they are observed and implemented by society or not, and complied with by society or not. The gist of that minor is identical with that of the previous, saying by Rabbi Hanani ben Chachinoi, that social iniquity and immorality are precipitated by the denial of divine authority. In other words, the vehicle of social ethics is faith in a transcendental personal God who expects man to follow in his footsteps or to imitate him. At the beginning, the Malcher of the skeptics says an essentially year are socially irrelevant, since it's possible to organize a society on the foundation of a man-made morality. However, they have realized finally, later, that without an ethic, man forfeits his ethical sensitivity and becomes oblivious of the most elementary principles of morality. Yeah, this is correct. Does history confirm that viewpoint? This is our viewpoint, not our viewpoint. I don't believe I told you anything new. I believe the best illustration, the best proof is Russia. And I want you to understand, when people speak about bankruptcy of religion and about the failure of the top clergymen, men of God, there are a lot of truths to the accusation. But as a whole, the accusation is false. Best proof that such an accusation is false, or mean, and undeserving is Russia. I do not assert that the West has achieved great moral life. Far from it. Western society is far from being perfect, a perfect moral community. It is hypocritical, great extent, sanctimonious. And self-righteous. And quite often, as we have experienced, indifferent to the woes and suffering of the downtrodden and weak people we have experienced in the foreign. However, the West is still somewhat sensitive to moral issues. You can argue with the government of which, so the argument is good or not, I don't know. But at least you have the opportunity to argue. You may argue, you may debate with our State Department officials. Whether it's helpful or it's a waste of time, I don't know. Those people go to Washington. They should decide. I don't know. Never mind. You may even engage Pompidou in an argument. Even Mrs. Pompidou. But she's responsible for the commotion. She's a kind of a manea, Khalila Khachareish, probably. When she was in Chicago, and she was in Chicago, and she administration to bring out to the administration was justified more than the different problem. Whether it was white politically, a different problem. But the administration took place was successful. Police has cleared the partnership and she's good. So she said to the gentleman, she complained, they touched me. So I reminded myself and I moved into the cave to answer. So the next door neighbor of mine was an old Irishman, but not even. He was descended old Irish star who came to America before the revolution. He was an Irish aristocrat. He used to say his family came long before the Kennedy family. And he was a gentleman, a perfect gentleman, a aristocrat. And still he looked typically Irish. Blue eyes, hard nose, and smile in his eyes. And he used to tell me, the little boy, he was an old man. He was very good. And the little boy, his mother used to take him to John Mars. So many years ago, 50 or 30 years ago, only the clan itself had become here and come well to speak of the bad thing, the good one. So I used to come and some of the young ladies came in circles to sell it. Sometimes we used to brush again then. So they moved to the end of the interview and identifying him as an Irish boy. Exactly what Mr. Sanford just said about the Jews. The touch. Well, but still you can argue with them. The West tries at least to justify its actions or its inaction, to explain, to at least somehow to fool us, to deceive us. It feels good. Many a time, and I'm ready to believe, embarrassed. And from time to time, the West is ready, even though feebly, to correct mistakes. What about Russia? About President Bush and Kosygin and Gornit? Can one reproach that? Can you debate any issue with them? Any rebuke will be scornfully rejected. It engages in no debate. It distorts facts, falsifies historical data. Accusing, for instance, accusing Little Israel of imperialism or colonialism, while she herself is the most brutal colonial imperialistic power, I would say, in human history. Jews committed an international crime when they invaded Egypt in order to protect the lives of the Jews and prevent Nasser from massacring 2 million Jews. That Nasser, who won the war, would be another Gandlinka and Schwent in Schloss Buchenwald, a few more camps, extermination camps in Europe. And Russia, of course, except in accordance with international morality, was motivated by the purest considerations and prevention of the Czechoslovakia. Russia is immoral, its very bone marrow, cruel and brutal, completely insensitive to morality. Why? It's a strange question. Marxism? People make any sense. Marxism is fundamentally an ethical doctrine. But far more ethical than an economic doctrine. The underlying idea of Marxist economics and econometrics is justice, fairness. Labor, according to Marx, creates the economic value system, hence the so-called Überwert belongs to the laborer, not to the investor or capitalist. And the fascination of Marxism for Oriental people, for African tribes, lies not in the economics, in the economic theory, but in the ethical material. Don't forget that Marxism, at the turn of the century, was a gospel, was a religion. People sacrifice their lives. And yet, these ethical doctrines turn into a gospel of brutality and tyranny. You want to know the answer? I have only one. The answer was provided by Chazal. All ten commandments were uttered in one sentence. They are indivisible and indestructible as a whole. Yes. However, the indivisibility of the ten commandments conveys to us another idea. Chazal, in stating that the Ten Commandments were spoken, formulated in one utterance, wanted expressing the indivisibility of the Decalogue, wanted also to convey another idea to us. It's indivisible just in the opposite direction, in reverse. Very important for Orthodox Jews to know, and modern Jews in particular. While one must neither separate the social norms from the theological faith premise, there is Yirtzoch, and there is Signet, and there is Sinos, and there is Anis, from Anichi Ad Hashem Rekecho. Nor should one try to accept the premise without embracing the rest of the divine. What the Haddus has proclaimed by integrating the principle of faith into the system of the moral law has revolutionary, it is of revolutionary character. First of all, there are no secular elements. Don't forget, Greeks, Romans didn't know about it. To them, ethics was secular. Because the very term of ethics, ethos, means social convention, social consent, social agreement, habits, common habits, common customs, certainly not the revealed norm, not the law. Hermann Cohen tries to show that Plato was different. Plato understood that the moral law is absolute and ultimate. It's not for men to break it. And if Plato did understand it, I have a good explanation. That Plato, that is quite possible that Plato visited Egypt, met in Egypt either Bor than a Rio or Edward. Of course, you know, German anti-Semite said that the ninth letter in Plato is not a sentence of truth. But he writes that he met with the wise men of the Orient, and he learned from them whatever was possible, whatever was possible to learn, to understand. Of course, it means that he met with Jews that the German historians could not tolerate. But he said, the letter is apocryphal. But the letter is not apocryphal. So it means if he actually came out with the idea, and he's lost, and as a matter of fact, the idea did not emerge, in his first word, but in his later word, like Avlid and the Lord. And so he certainly was influenced by Jews. I mean, don't forget that at the end of the decline of the first Commonwealth, the Jewish emigration from America to Egypt was powerful. Very strong, and many Jews settled in Egypt. And you learn the story about the Rio and Bar-Hapot. But anyway, this was number one that the Jews proclaimed the world. If the ethos is decreed by God, man cannot make his own law. Secondly, the Jews proclaimed another principle. Namely, the principle of existential unity. The latter, existential unity, is a condition sine qua non for the attainment of a perfect life. Go. and drinks every attribute. Turns into a moral norm, the Rambam, you know, the Rambam, Vamzeyu, Moran Shabbat, Mahua Ani. Men must try hard to achieve at least a relative ontological unity. He was created in the image of God. God is one in the most ultimate, the most absolute sense. Man cannot be one in the most ultimate, the absolute sense, because he has an inner contradiction within himself. He has an inner schism within himself, but he has to try to achieve some form of unity. Schism in man's life is something intolerable. And Yahadul has insisted, and this is very important for us to know, that life is not divided into two sectors, the mundane and the sacred, or the street and the synagogue, or the office and the house of worship. Unity is inherent in the very fabric of human existence. The latter, the existence, can be either completely mundane or completely sacred. He is confronted with his maker not only in the house of worship, where he is ready for the meeting, but also in places he does not expect God to be found. And Avodas Hashem is associated with the entire human existence, with this complete, colorful spectrum, with a complete, colorful spectrum of one's life. God is worshipped not only through the offering of sacrifices, through prayer, prostration, but also and perhaps mainly through practicing social morality, through displaying kindness toward one's fellow man, through extending help to the needy, and treating one's subordinate differently. The example personification of that, please don't accuse me of trying to promote my own members of my own family, who was my grandfather of mine. He actually once had made a belief told me, he asked three people, three rabbis out in the family, what the past of a world should consist of. He asked Rav Hashulchan, his grandfather. He asked for the foil of a Lodner or a Khan. Rav Hashulchan sent for him, the past of a world, the past of a child. It's called Rav Hashulchan. The kind said, the task of the world, silence? Yes. Silence is the task of silence of the world. You can do it any other than that. As I, my job is to help the needy, to protect the persecuted, to defend the widow if someone, some powerful person is persecuting her, or is inflicting some harm. To feed the orphan, because Abchaim Chesed was absolutely fantastic. As a matter of fact, you know, Abchaim left in Savoy, there's no title being inscribed on the tombstone. And the children of complying with Savoy, with one exception, Rabchaim. Abchaim Goyen, Rashid Behar, that's all revolutionaries, the hero world. And if you ask me what Rav Chaim Ha'ili, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, certainly, for what to happen. Stories about when, you know, the children, the illegitimate children are adopted, fed up, before the Nazis and the Haidas at school. I mean, the story about the revolutionary, you know, and Kita, he saved his wife, Rav Chaim. And so forth, I mean, it is